Well, hi everybody. Welcome. My name is Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I'm in New York, and really nice to see everybody tonight and welcome those that are new. So tonight I'm gonna jump into Bill's story. I am gonna briefly, really, really briefly, someone had reached out to me and said that they thought it would be very helpful. They've heard me talk about my pictures and they asked if I would just share them. So I'm going to share them quickly. I don't want to spend a lot of time in them. And let me see where it is. Okay, here we go. So hopefully you're able to see. Here we go. So tonight, I'm going to talk about Bill's story. And Bill's story, starts off with, well, with him as he is, as he was, and then you really get to hear about his incredible decline right before he recovers. And I have visible demonstrations of what it looked like when I was in decline. So this was, I've been recovered, I've been abstinent over 10 years and recovered shortly after I became abstinent. It really happened quickly. But this is what it looked like for me living with the disease and morbid obesity. I was always, always fighting, always battling, always trying to lose weight, always regaining it. You would see me on vacation binging. You would see me at, this was a family party, binging. It didn't matter what was happening, whether it was good or bad. Food always found me. This was me at, a lot of my pictures were taken at happy events. And so if you'd say like, oh, you must have been, maybe you ate because you were so unhappy because there was so much sorrow in your life. No, not true. I created, a lot of it was I created my own sorrow. I had my own perception, my own view of what life was around me. And it was faulty. It wasn't real. So this was me, with my sister, my sister-in-laws. These people loved me. They've always loved me. They're just like me, loud, opinionated, overbearing, well-meaning at times. And I could not stand to be in the company of people who loved me so much because of my self-centeredness, my disease. And so a lot of these pictures, you would see me drinking and eating and just being, fake smile, really miserable. Fake smile, real miserable. And this is a more recent picture. This is what it looks like to have recovered. This was me when my son was little. I could barely put my arms around him. I was miserable. And these are, I love this. These are like three side-by-side photos. Same kid, same husband. He's just not in this last picture. But, that's what it looks like to be in the disease. To be owned by food, food is your master, to have recovered, to be happy in your release. And there's countless photos like this. I said I was just gonna buzz through them quick. In the gray, I've already recovered. My body just was in the process of catching up because it's a process when you're, I, you know, along with abstaining from compulsive overeating and eating, outside of the way I should be, part of it is I also refrain from schemes and quick fixes and diets. So it took my body a while to catch up where it was meant to be. And this is me, over the course of many years. Every one of those dresses fits me. I've gotten older, but I can go in the closet and every one of those dresses fits me. And that's just nothing short of a miracle. There's me with my siblings again, one of those dresses, family photos again. So, and this is me and my husband. I love this because here we were in a restaurant. That's what we did all the time because when food is your master, food tells you what you like to do. And here's what it looks like to live free. We love like concerts and music festivals and dancing and being out there and having fun. And that's what, I'm going to stop sharing my photos now, but that hopefully, the purpose of me sharing them, I think the person who asked me to share them had, she had someone in mind who's probably early on in their recovery journey who might need some encouragement. And I hope my intention with those photos is not to never to be like, oh, look how great I am. It has nothing to do with me. It was a gift I received from God. The physical transformation is a gift I receive. And the reason I show it is that I want to encourage people. I want you to believe it is possible. It actually is possible. And I feel like, I've had a transformation that speaks volumes about the power of God and miracles. And so I believe it's my responsibility to show it so that others can hopefully, get inspired that God really can do for me what I could never do for myself. So let's jump into Bill's story. And, we're going to get right into page one, first paragraph. It says, here was love. Okay, I eat when I'm feeling loved. Applause. I eat when I'm being celebrated and getting accolades. War. Yep, I eat when there's chaos and sadness. Moments sublime. I eat when life is extremely grand, with intervals of hilarious. Yep. Times of good humor and joy. I have no problem eating through that too. I was a part of life at last. In the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings of and the prejudice of my people concerning drink. So I don't know about you all, but I grew up in a home where I knew that certain foods were unhealthy. It wasn't like, oh, that poor girl, she didn't know that that kind of food was bad for her. Totally knew it. I was encouraged to eat in moderation. I was my family definitely had views about people who ate the way that I ate. My father's side of the family was morbidly obese. I'm sure that they were all compulsive overeaters. In fact, I had an uncle and an aunt who definitely died as a result of morbid obesity. Their organs stopped working. And when I was a little girl, my parents would point them out as the cautionary tale. Like, don't let yourself get like that. Look at them. So, didn't help. It was never like, oh, well, thank you so much for telling me. Now I'll never eat that way again. Like one thing had nothing to do with the other. And then it says here, in times we sailed for over there, I was very lonely and again turned to God. So what I learned from that paragraph is, Bill drank when things were great and he drank when he was lonely. He drank despite having been informed that drinking wasn't good. And so what that tells me is lack of knowledge was never my dilemma. Never the dilemma. Food was what I used to celebrate and enhance the happy occasions, and it was what I used to soothe myself. And what this confirms is that it's not my circumstances that need to be adjusted, but my response to my circumstances, right? So here it says, I fancied myself a leader. My talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. And then it says, the drive for success was on. I proved to the world that I was important. So, when I read this, I can't help but think Bill wanted desperately to be something, to be important, to succeed. And he was clearly determined. He was intelligent and he was driven. And I think a lot of people are. I think there's nothing wrong per se with wanting to be something. I think that's a pretty, I think about like I teach second grade. If I ask any little boy in my class, they all want to be a famous soccer player. Pretty normal response, right? Or they want to be an astronaut. Like everybody wants to be something. And so I don't think that addicts are necessarily weak-willed or lazy or more desirous of being something, but I know that I'm self-centered, I'm self-important, and I'm looking for outward approval, desperately looking for outward approval. And unlike a second grader, I didn't outgrow it, right? Most second graders reach a certain age and they realize, they're not going to be the famous soccer player. Like, it's probably not going to happen. And they sort of reset their dreams, right? They reset it and they work for different things. They start putting their dreams into hard labor and work. And I think many of us instead resort to fantasy and soothing ourselves with food. I lived my whole life, someday when I'm thin, I'll. Someday when I'm thin, I'll. Someday when I'm thin, I'll. Which basically said, I don't have to do squat now. Pass me the Oreos. You know, that was definitely the way that I lived. And so, is it a problem to want to have success? Is it a problem? And it could be if our motives are entirely selfish motives. And I think, you know, I always like to say, we're going to come back to this question. Is it wrong to have ambition? We'll come back to that. And here it says, potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. So here's Bill. He's having consequences already. Although he's not so disturbed, is he? It's only disturbing his wife. You know, if it's enough that he's failing in school, that it's disturbing his wife, then it's a problem. But until we feel deep down inside that it's a problem, we can't even begin to admit powerlessness and defeat. So I know for me, there might have been other people in my world who were thinking, you've got a problem. You ought to do something about it. But until I came to the end of me, internally knew it, nothing anybody on the outside could say was going to do anything. Page three, for the next few years, fortune through money and applause my way had arrived. Self-important, right? Here's what I see. Self-important. And I've heard it said that the addict is an example of an egomaniac with low self-esteem. That's what it sounds like here. Like wanting to be something, needing a lot of outward accolades. Now we see the progression. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. And then it says,
Recording in
my
progress.
drinking assumed.
Hold on, let's see what's going on here.
I mean, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. Unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. Okay, so what do we see here? Important and exhilarating, like that's what the food was taking for me, that's what the drink was taking. Serious and continual, alienating him from his friends and causing unhappiness in his marriage. So consequences are not enough to stop us because clearly here are some consequences. We may start out enjoying the food and even having a good time binging, but this is a progressive disease. If you have this, it's progressive. So I know for me, I went from weekends like pig out parties, right? I went from like times when I would like sneak food sometimes, overeating sometimes, you know, to it used to be where I would fit the binging into my life. And then it progressed to where I was fitting my life into my binging, right? Like the binging took more important part of my life. And then at the end, for me, binging just ruled my life, right? I couldn't fit my life around my binging anymore. And, you know, so here it also goes on that there had been no real infidelity. For loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. And I would say this, you know, there was infidelity. He was unfaithful because what he was married to was the food, was it the alcohol, right? And that's what it was for me, that, food was my master. And it will say that here too, that alcohol was his master. When food is your master, it comes before your marriage, it comes before your children, and it even tells you what you enjoy doing. It demands complete fidelity. So when I show those pictures in the beginning of me holding my son and him looking down, like I remember those times. Like I knew that my weight was interfering with my parenting. And but food was my master. And so it actually demanded more of me than I had available to give my baby. Right. And here it says, I began to be jittery in the morning. And golf permitted drinking every day and every night. What I always think, like when I read this, like Bill talks about golf here, and it doesn't sound like he has a deep love for the game. I mean, God help him if he did. I don't understand that, but that's a whole other issue. But he doesn't sound like he's passionate about the game of golf. Like he's, loving it and thinking about how he's going to improve the game because he just feels so passionate about it. And actually, what it sounds like is that he's doing it because he can feel like a hot shot when he does it. It's something that people, it's statusy, sport to be playing. And most importantly, I think this is the most important part, is that it's a leisure activity that he can do and drink all day and all night. And I know for myself, there were lots of things that I chose to do and people I chose to hang out with and places I chose to go because food would just be wildly available and nobody would be looking at what I ate and my body could comfortably do it, right? And so, when food was my master, I didn't kayak, I didn't hike, I didn't swim. No, because you can't really do those things and eat. But I went to restaurants. Oh, there were loads of pictures of me at restaurants. And that's what I thought I liked to do. I did things that I could sit. I love the movies. You could eat in the dark and not have to move. And that's a good question to ask yourself. Are you doing things because food allows you to do it? Or are you doing things because it's truly what you enjoy? Page five, liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. And there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. So, like, I think it's like, let's look at this again. Let's look at this progression again. Important, exhilarating, then serious, continuous, alienation, unhappiness, extreme drunkenness, jitteriness, but a necessity. And here's the crazy part. He still thought he had the ability to control the situation, right? Can you relate? I can relate to that. I think a big symptom of this disease is not thinking that it's a big deal. It's part of the insanity. The mind is under the control of the food, but it thinks it's able to control the problem. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business. And so I did. And how do we really begin to know that we're powerless. Like, how do you know for sure that you're really powerless? Well, remember that prior to this, he thought he could control the situation. He had no idea he was powerless, right? Because he thought he was in control. But now he knows he has to stop altogether. And he promises to stop. I have made countless promises to stop too. I've made countless commitments. Every time I promised myself or others that I would stop, I really didn't understand that I couldn't. I really thought that I had. You know, I remember being away, you know, and it was actually on my honeymoon that I ate so much that none of my clothes fit me. And I had been abstinent right up until the time of my honeymoon. But I didn't know I was powerless. I had a food plan. My food plan was my God. My abstinence was God. Food plan was my religion. And I really thought on that honeymoon, I was like, I am having a great time. I am eating. I'm having fun. I'm drinking. I'm doing what I want. I 100% will get right back on my plan when I got home. I had no idea I was powerless. You know when I realized I was powerless? When I got home and I went to the grocery store and I bought all the foods that were abstinent and they rotted in my refrigerator because I couldn't get on that plan. Every time I made that promise, that commitment, and my car, like a magnet, went right through Burger King and McDonald's. I began to understand, wait, I think I'm powerless. I can't stop myself. And so, you know, he knows he has to stop altogether. He promises to stop. And here's the thing, we are powerless to live within the boundaries of your own information about what is not good for you. That's what it was for me. Could not. When you had the information, I couldn't live within the boundaries of knowing that information. I can make up my mind to stop doing something, and yet my mind is powerless to remain made up. I have no mental defense. That's what it means to have no mental defense. You know, so here he is, right? He makes this commitment, and what happens? Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder. For such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. You know, and I love the Big Book gives us a lot of really workable definitions. And a lot of times people don't like to be told that they have, that there's a insanity. They don't like the idea that there's a mental problem here, that they're crazy, right? I didn't like hearing that. But the Big Book gives me a really good definition that kind of helped me get it. And one of the definitions that we're given is the definition of crazy and insane. And here it says, crazy is an appalling lack of perspective. And in the chapter more about alcoholism, we're given the definition for insanity, which is almost the same thing. It's in Jim's story, it's on page 37. It says this, whatever the precise definition may be, we call this plain insanity. For how can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? So, lacking perspective and lacking proportion means making things that are unimportant hugely important. And then things that are crucial seem insignificant. And it's important in step one to admit our insanity. And since there's so much stigma surrounding the word, it's important for us to understand that it's not just a melodramatic term, right? It's not just this melodramatic turn. But if I don't have the ability to understand what's crucially important, and I make things that are seemingly, you know, unimportant really important, I've got a big problem here. And here's a key example. What could be more important than my life? Right? It's the only one I've got. And yet, I've been in situations where I have said, I know I can't eat a certain food. I know that it triggers this allergic response in me, but I don't want to insult my hostess. I don't want to have to ask the waitress to bring that food back. I don't want to like stand out. Why is that? Because I lack the ability to think straight. I lack proportion. I lack perspective. And here's a great example, right? Again, I'm going to get back to being a teacher. I have kids in my class. Every year, I've got a kid in my class who has a peanut allergy. Their parents never worry about offending me or any other parent. By the way, they don't care about offending the whole school if they have to make the cafeteria peanut free. Why is that? Because they don't lack perspective. Because they know that the very life that they're trying to protect is more important than possibly offending anybody. Can I say the same thing about the way that I've treated my disease? Heck no. Heck no. Right? Therefore, I lack perspective. I lack proportion. Good news. I don't lack perspective anymore. I don't lack proportion anymore. I have no problem. Anybody who has seen me at places and been with me in places, whether it's a retreat or whether it's at a restaurant, I can do it with clarity. I can do it with poise. I don't have to act like a lunatic, but I absolutely don't lack proportion. I can advocate for what I know has the capacity to save my very life. And here he was, he couldn't. Someone pushed a drink his way and he took it, right? I cannot fight the magnetic pull of the food. I don't have enough strength and power. In fact, by the way, we're never given that promise. What we get is even better. We get a better promise. For us, the problem gets removed, right? It's not like I have to rely on my strong willpower to fight against it. It's like this, the magnet that was inside the food that would call my name, it's like the magnet just gets boop, taken out. No more magnet. Gone. Page five, renewing my resolve. What's a resolve? Firm determination to do something. I tried again. Some time had passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills now. I had what it takes. One day, I walked into a cafe to telephone, and in no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. And then on page seven, Bill goes into a hospital and he meets Dr. Sokol, who gives him some excellent information, but information is not transformation. It's not enough. And understanding ourselves does not give us the ability to live in agreement with what we understand. So when he finds out, and here it is, and when he meets Dr. Sokol, right? Though certainly full, selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally. And the doctor's opinion explains that we have a two-part illness, right? The allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. We are seriously sick in our minds and in our bodies. Yes, selfish. Yes, foolish, but sick as well. And, here it says it relieved me to learn, somewhat to learn, that the alcoholic, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. So we can be strong-willed and competent in other areas, but have no willpower where food is concerned. Understanding myself now, I feared for it and I hope, and this was surely the answer, self-knowledge, right? He thought for sure, now that you've told me, okay, I got it. You gave me the information. Self-knowledge will fix it. But it doesn't keep him sober. And he actually ends up worse than ever. Self-knowledge, by the way, is relying on a mental defense. And we don't have that, right? We don't have a mental defense. Page eight, quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. When I read this, I think about what it means to have food be your master. You know, it means, and I shared this before, but I'm going to kind of drill it in again. Food tells you what to do, where to go, who to spend time with. If you're under the control of a master, it means you are going to need an outside intervening force to overpower the master and set you free. You can't set yourself free. Clearly, what does that mean? You're going to need a higher power. You're going to need something more powerful than you. That's a higher power, right? And certainly than the food. And you know what? Bill gets just that. Bill gets just that. You know, it says here how dark it is before the dawn. And, you know, notice how that comes right before the miracle. It says how dark it is before the dawn. And to me, this is proof that I can only see that things are bad. I could be in the midst of something that looks awful. And I say, oh, this is terrible. This is the worst. You know, and I love to think too, we don't suffer from a hopeless situation, a hopeless condition. We suffer from a seemingly hopeless condition. Because if it were hopeless, you wouldn't have seen my photos and seen me recovered. If it was hopeless, you wouldn't hear about, you know, someone who's going to do a young person's meeting who, you know, who isn't that young person anymore. Sorry
Watch it. Watch it.
to hear that. Careful, careful, right? So that ought to tell you that it's not hopeless. It's seemingly hopeless. It appears to be hopeless. How dark it is before the dawn, right? You know, it's not actually hopeless because if it were, Bill would never have experienced what comes next. And I love this. Here, what comes next? I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Isn't that beautiful? Right? He gets catapulted, not by his own power, right? We don't catapult ourselves, but something, some intervening higher power, God, actually picks him up and launches him into a whole new existence. And so now what happens to this man that once needed approval and money and needed to be somebody? What happens is he found God and he found a purpose. And here for me, I love this. Here's the best part, the next part of the story. I just love it. You know, Bill's story can get really horrible and awful and bleak and worse and worse and worse. And I love getting up to the bright spot, the wonderful part. And here it is. The door opened. And he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? And, you know, I love how it says the door opened. Not Bill opened the door, Ebby opened the door. You can almost hear that there's the power of God there, that this door just opened. It's like, I often think about myself. I feel like I was living my life in this story, this that was just the most devastating, horrible, sad tale. And I feel like something miraculous happened where I was just picked up, The page was turned and I was put in a new story and a new life. And it's kind of like this, the door opened, right? There he is, the door opens. And I love, the way Ebby shows up, I think for me and for any of us, it's how we're supposed to carry the message. Look like you have a message. He had that starry-eyed look, right? Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But here's the thing, he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told him of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. And so the next part of the chapter now delves into the struggles Bill had to work out internally to allow himself to come to believe. And it's pretty incredible that he shares this process with us, this coming to believe process. On page 10, it says, I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlie it all. I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone. So what Bill has is a belief in an idea, but no relationship, and certainly no reliance. He then goes on to point out all the ways God had failed him, and in his mind, the whole world. God just failed him and everything. And so what does he do? He points out the wars and religious people who didn't act very religious. And what does Ebby tell him? How he was saved, right? He shared his experience with Bill. And because Bill had known what a disaster he had been, that his words of transformation were self-evident. And I think that's important for us. When we get well, we are walking, breathing examples of God's miraculous power, which tells me that when people in my community ask what I did to lose weight, I have an obligation, a responsibility to give God the credit, right? And when somebody says that they struggle with forming their own conception, I love to say what Ebby says, like, I don't know about all those things. I can't explain away life's disasters and tragedies. I don't have that knowledge. I don't have that ability. But I can tell you, God did for me what I could not do for myself. Right? And then we let our lives demonstrate that. Page 10, when they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated. And my mind snapped shut against such a theory. And I read this and I think, why was that irritating to Bill? Well, like me, he points out all the things that are not right with the world, and this makes him question God. And I used to do the same thing. But Ebby tells him this, right? God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed, right? And that doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was going to lock him up. And then he admitted complete defeat. And he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he'd ever known. Page 11, here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. And that's the beautiful truth. We are miracles. We in this program have the opportunity to meet miracles and to become a miracle. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped new soil. And I just love this. I think, we're more than normal sized bodies. When I think about my roots grasping new soil, here's what I think about, right? My roots are the things that grab onto the soil for support and nourishment. And at one time, the soil that my roots grasped were the things that my selfish roots needed. My roots were selfish. And so what did they cling to? What did they hang on to for nourishment and support? Basically, getting all my needs and wishes met. That's what the soil was. If it was gonna make me happy, I thought happy was what my goal was. Be happy, get everything you want, be happy. And today my roots are planted in my relationship with God. And I think there's something really, when we're newly getting recovered, I think the process of the 12 steps is a digging out my roots from polluted soil, shaking out that old polluted soil, and getting them transplanted in new soil, right? It's a process. And there's a very vulnerable period of time, I believe, for people. When your roots are like yanked out, you're shaking off that old soil, and they're kind of left dangling. And I think that's the part where the fellowship and the help and the support comes in. It's like our job is to help people quickly. Come on, let's get your roots in some new soil together. Page 12, when the thought was expressed that there may be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified, and I didn't like the idea. And I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of the Tsar of the heavens, however loving his sway may be. And I've since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. It's funny. We truly, so many of us come in here, we think we're so unique. Oh, I'm the only one who has a problem with God. I remember like whispering it to people, like, I got a God problem. Like, no joke, you have a God problem because you think you're it. How can you find God when you believe that you're God? And, many of us have this idea that there's something big and mysterious out there. But thought of forming a working relationship with this big, powerful source seems frightening and unbelievable. And so, here's what his friend suggested. It's a novel idea. Choose your own conception. And what that statement did for him, did for me too, it melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. So, what does it take? It's a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more of me was required to make my beginning. Growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. So, when people say, I'm struggling with step two because I don't have a conception of God yet, I'm not sure what God is yet, that's not necessarily the requirement. It's, do you want a relationship with God? Is this something you want? And if you're struggling to believe, do you want to believe? That's what I ask people who say that they're not sure they believe yet. I ask, well, do you want to? And if you want to, that means you're willing to. That means you're willing to believe. A conception is just a beginning. I don't believe we get to make up God. A conception is where you start, right? And we're encouraged to seek God now and then to continue to seek. And on page 13, it says that he was separated from alcohol. He humbled himself to God as he understood him, to do with me as he would. He placed himself unreservedly under his care and direction, admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. And I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch. I've not had a drink since. And I, you know, my schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. And so, if you remember in the beginning of this talk, I said we would come back to the question of ambition. Is ambition inherently bad? Is it such a bad thing to be driven and to have a desire for success? Well, it could be if our motives were selfish motives, if my roots were still in selfish soil. But at this point in his story, what happens to Bill is he turns his life, his entire life, over to his higher power, over to God. And what happens then? His motives become God-directed. And so this same incredibly ambitious guy who had a need for success, the drive was on, what does God do? He takes this incredibly brilliant man who's ambitious and creative and uses him, uses that desire to help thousands and millions of others. If Bill were not ambitious and successful, I don't think I would be here today, right? So it's not inherently bad when we put ourselves in God's hands, right? And so what happens is he begins to think about thousands of others that could benefit. And I love how quickly Bill goes from self-centered to his eyes fixed on how he can help others. To me, that's a true miracle. And I have to say, when I work with sponsees, it's unbelievable how that happens in people through the steps. You see that transformation by the time we get to step 12. Actually, most people, by the time they're at step 9, they're already telling me about people they know that I think I can help this person, or I've been talking to so and so, and I want to try to help them, because that's what happens when we place ourselves unreservedly in God's hand, in God's hands, right? And so here, this is designed for living that works in rough going. Most of us feel we need to look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. And with that, I will pass like 2 minutes.